We now come to the next item on the programme. The director of the Royal Anthropological Institute tells me that for reasons of procedural propriety, I can't be introduced by anyone. So I'm in the disagreeable situation of having to introduce myself. I could tell you that I don't need an introduction and then proceed to bore you with details about my life. I won't do this. I'll just say this is my swan song. This is kind of the end of my tenure of you know, being the president fainéant of the Royal Anthropological Institute. My successor, whom I welcome, is close here. At NEMI, they had this disagreeable custom of eliminating the post holder by his successor. I can see his knife shining. But at NEMI, they were civilized. They didn't make the previous holder make a speech before he disappeared. Well, that is my lot this evening, and I'm about to do so. Well, I'll go straight into... I won't bore you with any further preliminaries. I'll go straight into the heart of the matter. I'll begin by making a few remarks, the relevance of which may appear later, about the First World War. Now, the First World War was the first proper industrial war, and it had the feature of industrialism, namely, things are done by machines, things are done on a large scale, and all romance is destroyed. I think that these three features characterize industrial activity. And, of course, the First World War had all these characteristics. People weren't killed by guns, they were killed by machine guns. They weren't killed in small numbers, but in enormous large numbers. And they were killed in extremely unromantic circumstances, which really deprived their death of any kind of glamour. Basically, surrounded by mud and dysentery. The Prague writer Egon Erwin Kisch, who took part in the Austrian initial advance into Serbia, the Austrians were thrown back twice by the Serbians in chaos, reports one of the poems, very characteristic couplet the Austrian soldiers made up as they were trying to cross the Drina. After Drin, Lindverfurt, after Latrine. Loosely translated, we're endlessly on the bog. It was dysentery was even more formidable than the Serbs. And I think this set the tone for the entire war. It was death in mud and dysentery. And the characteristic literary expressions were, of course, goodbye to all that, farewell to arms, all quiet on the Western Front, which catched it. But there was a way, and this next step in my argument, there was a way of escaping the squalor and the mud and the dysentery, and that was to fight not in the mud of the Somme or the Piave or the Drina, but to do so in the sunshine, in the desert, in small groups, in a kind of romantic way, combining long-distance glamorous raids with intricate tribal politics. And it's no accident that given that most of the war was fought in the mud, that the person who managed to restore some glamour to this activity, whether or not it deserved it, was indeed an Arabist, scholar, adventurer, writer, romantic. And now I'm going to see whether the contraption works. It's an unusual photograph of the man because you don't usually see him with a beard hiding that well-known big chin. But here the scholar, romantic, Arabist, and warrior in the desert. And for reasons which will emerge in the course of my lecture, I'm making him the theme of my talk. Well, I hope that most of you think that I'm talking about T.E. Lawrence. I'm not. You might well think this was T.E. Lawrence. In fact, it is Alois Musil. And in preparing this talk, I did a certain amount of survey research and found whether anybody had heard of him. And in most cases, people hadn't heard of him at all. Once or twice, they say, he's the author of The Man Without Qualities. Well, he isn't. He is the second cousin. And this is also going to be significant of the man who wrote Man Without Qualities. They shared a common great-grandfather. But Alois Musil's significance is very, very considerable. And the fact that he's not known is also significant. And I shall, much of my lecture is going to be, first of all, about him, and then about the reasons for his significance. Alois Musil was born in 1868. He lived on to 1944. He was born of Moravian peasant stock, sufficiently prosperous to have their peasant, their house was quite a decent shape, but they were unambiguously peasants. The Robert Musil branch of the family, the novelist branch, rose in the world in the course of which they became Germanized, whereas Alois Musil's branch remained very profoundly Czech. Robert Musil's branch acquired a fond in the process of their ascension, although Robert Musil didn't deign to use it. But let me first of all talk about Alois Musil. Alois Musil went to secondary school in his native Moravia, and before he terminated it, decided he had a vocation for the church, which he joined. Now, his vocation was very profound, and was inspired not only by faith, but also by intellectual curiosity. And the central curiosity of his life, which stayed with him throughout, was the problem of monotheism. What were the roots, and indeed the consequences, of the belief in a single, exclusive, moralistic deity, which monotheism in the Puritan sense, a deity which spurns the employment of mediators, of ritual, or of special buildings. He was received into the church. He came under the patronage of the famous Archbishop Cohn of Olomouc, who, like Musil, was of rustic Moravian background, though, of course, as his name indicates, of Jewish background. The no doubt apocryphal story was told that when Cohn was promoted to Archbishop, which of course had to be countersigned by Franz Josef, Franz Josef was heard to observe, "Ist er wenigstens getauft?" The real point, of course, is that Cohn refused to yield to any kind of anti-Semitic pressure and to change his name. Later in his life, he was forced by the then Pope to resign. And Musil also had his troubles with the church, was severely accused of giving naturalistic accounts of the events of the Old Testament. Anyway, his concern with monotheism led him, of course, into theology and Old Testament studies, and indeed to the Middle East, and led him to learn first Hebrew and then Arabic. And he initially made his name as a cartographer of the Old Testament. He did a great deal of exploratory work, in the course of which he drew the map of the Old Testament events, which were then more or less unmapped. For instance, he came to the conclusion, which is extremely plausible to me, that the Mount Sinai on which it happened is not identical with the mountain now so named, It doesn't actually make sense. If you're escaping from Egypt across the Red Sea and have succeeded in escaping, you're not going to turn back and climb an arid mountain and get closer to the Egyptians in the process. The real Mount Sinai, the one actually fitting the biblical description, is to the southeast of Aqaba, a volcanic mountain which fits the logic of the situation and the indication given in the narrative. Now, Musil became quite well known for this cartographic work, so much so that the consequences of it still have political implications today. In 1906 or 7, I forget the date, the then Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, thought in the interest of tidiness there ought to be a clear line between what were then British-occupied Egypt and Ottoman-occupied Palestine, and somebody had to be found to draw the map, somebody who actually knew this bit of desert. And in fact, Alois Musil was selected and drew the line on the map, which obviously couldn't be drawn by the local Bedouin who are not given to drawing lines and maps, nor the Ottomans, who didn't really care about maps either. This had a curious consequence, because when much later in the century the Israelis built the seaport and resort of Eilat, they also built a hotel on its western outskirts, and the Egyptians claimed that they had trespassed and this territory was in fact theirs. And it was Musil's map which established the Egyptian point. The fame of Musil for these activities was sufficient to get the British to try and enlist him in their secret service on at least three occasions, but he declined. Had he accepted, it would have had very interesting consequences. However, in the course of his travels, he gradually became convinced that the clue to monotheism lay not specifically in the Old Testament, but in desert life as such. It's an interesting coincidence that just about the same time as Malinowski was getting ready to transform anthropology from speculative theorizing about the past into a study of the actual contemporary and synchronic functioning of simpler societies, Musil was, as it were, doing the same without theorizing about it. His interest switched from the societies of the Old Testament to the contemporary Bedouin. He didn't abandon the other interest. His interest was inspired by the theory which he upheld to the end of his life, namely that monotheism is a product of the desert, and that the societies of the patriarchal society of the Old Testament resembles the patriarchal Bedouin society of his own time. And in due course, he chose as the most interesting and representative North Bedouin tribe the Ruwala, of which he in due course became an honorary sheikh. And of course, he is known, in as far as he is known in the West at all, it is for the ethnography of the Ruwala, which he published in English after the war in 1928 under the name of Manners and Customs of the Ruwala Bedouin, 1928. I think it was Chicago, though it was in fact printed in Prague. Anyway, he became not merely a cartographer of the Old Testament, but also an ethnographer of the then contemporary Bedouin, and of course, in his mind, the two themes were intimately connected. This, however, had a number of interesting consequences. One, and this is, of course, the most romantic, but not, I think, perhaps the most important aspect of his career. When the war came, he became the T.E. Lawrence of the other side. And I think he was rather more successful than Lawrence. He conceived his task as the establishment of a kind of Pax Austriaca in northern Arabia, in the area between Palestine, Syria, and Iraq, in trying to ensure that the various Bedouin tribes and statelets and semi-states did not fight each other, above all, didn't attack the Turks, and if possible, attacked the allies of the British or the British themselves. He even dreamt of leading a Bedouin expedition against Egypt, though this never fully came off. He achieved this with much smaller resources than Lawrence. The Turks didn't trust him. Enver Pasha particularly disliked him, and it's, I think, warmly reciprocated, and tried to trip him up. Lawrence and he knew of each other. Lawrence referred in a letter to him, saying something funny is happening in Damascus. There is this Austrian advising the Turkish general staff, and he added wryly, I hope they take more notice of his expertise than the English do of mine. Musil didn't comment on Lawrence till after Lawrence's death, when he spoke about him on Prague radio, expressing doubts about both his competence in Arabic and about his military skill. He thought he was followed for his gold and not for his charisma, but he did admire him as a writer. He said he was the best practitioner of the genre, he didn't define the genre, since the Napoleonic Wars, but he did refer to him, he did refer to the Lawrence legend. And thus, Musil achieved more, not only because he nominally he achieved higher rank. He ended up as the biographers give him two ranks, successor of as a major general and as a sub-field marshal in the Count Ka army. I wonder if that...
The contraption isn't working.
That is Lawrence, that is Musil the priest. He never lost his faith, and I'm going to come back to that. This is Lawrence the Sheikh, Musil the Sheikh, I beg your pardon. This photograph illustrates the cover, I mean the front page of his customs and manners of the Rawala Bedouin. It was reviewed in ISIS by George Sutton, who comments that there's virtually no documentation in the book. Fieldwork studies obviously weren't quite recognized, and says the photograph is described, the photo of Sheikh Musa Rawali, and he says, Alois Musil must have got all his material from the learned Sheikh Musa Wally. Well, yes, he did indeed. I mean, Musa was Musil. And of course, it's very significant of his preoccupation with monotheism that he chose the name Musa when he dressed up. And like, he was certainly very much like Lawrence in that he loved dressing up. But here you see him as a very model of a Count Ka major general, covered with medals. And I think there is no army in the world other than the Königliche Kaiserliche Army, where major generals have quite such soulful eyes. But he had these multiple, as you see, he had these multiple roles. In his his activities amongst the Bedouin were very, very, very interesting. He was closely involved in the fighting between the Shamar, who were emphatically on the Turkish side, and the Saudis, then a very minor power subsidized by the British and ambiguously allied to the British. And in this capacity, he was very close to the death of the British agent, with the Saudis on the other side.
which he didn't actually do it, but he spoke to the man who did do it and reported in a book published in Czech in Prague in 1931 among the Shamar, and I'll read out the description of the killing of the British agent with the Saudis. This happened in January 1915. This was described to him as Musil described in the Black Ibrahim An-Nodeli. This revolver I took from the Englishman at Ajrab. He had a big white hat and fired the gun. He fired 7 shots, but none of them did any harm. They fell in the sand without exploding. We threw ourselves at the defenders of the gun and drove them off. The Englishman didn't run away, but remained with the gun to the last moment. Seeing himself abandoned, he looked for his horse, but this had been taken by the fleeing defenders. He ran on foot, sinking in the sand. I urged my mare, suddenly a shot. My mare falls and I with it. I followed the Englishman on foot. I am used to the sand and he's not, and I am barefoot and he's in boots. I soon caught up with him. He stopped, turned, raised his hands above his hand, smiling. I shot at him and hit him in his side. He fell to his knees and again raised his hands. I drew my sword and split his head. He must have had about 40 years. His clothes, Saud ibn Suban sent to Medina. Medina was still Turkish occupied. Very characteristically, Musil tells this story in a completely deadpan way, without judgment. He doesn't name the Englishman. It was, of course, Captain Shakespeare, who was the British agent with the Saudis. An interesting aspect of the episode is that whilst Musil reported this event correctly and directly to Baron Burian, the then Austrian foreign minister, in February, in June he also wrote a letter to the German ambassador in Istanbul in which he must have deliberately misdescribed the event, and I quote, the unfortunate European gunner, he says, was presumably a Dutchman from Batavia, a mercenary in the service of Faisal al-Rashid. And he says explicitly that he was present at the fighting at Ajrab. The British referred to it as the Battle of Jarab. And for some reason, he wanted the Germans to think that the British were not involved with the Saudis and that the fighting wasn't serious. He goes on to say that the fighting wasn't really with the Saudis, but between 2 segments of the Shamar, one of whom had deserted over to the Saudis. He was deliberately trying to mislead the Germans. Quite why, I'm not very clear, but there's no doubt about what he was doing. This was the glamorous aspect of his participation in the war, and he really did ensure that the deathered flanks of the 2 Turkish armies facing the British, the one in Mesopotamia facing the British coming up from Basra, and the other one in Palestine facing the British coming in from Egypt, had their flanks covered and weren't being attacked. And the fact that Lawrence only succeeded in making an impact very late in the war, the fact that those little trains kept chugging on to Medina, shows how successful Musil had been. This, however, is not the only point at which he's made a major impact on the First World War. It's certainly the most romantic. There was another consequence of his distinction and fame as Arabist and Middle East expert. Prince Sixtus of Bourbon Parma, whose sister was the wife of the Crown Prince under Franz Josef, wanted to travel in the Middle East, romanticism, political influence, or whatever. So an expedition was arranged of which Prince Sixtus was the nominal head, but Musil was the real head, and the two men became close friends. And in particular, Musil had great influence on Zita, the wife of the Crown Prince. When Franz Josef died in 1916,
Karl became the last Austrian Kaiser, and Vita the last Kaiserin, and Musil now had a very, 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 very close connection to the court. Interestingly enough, there were two priests, he and Father Schmidt, the head of the Austrian Anthropological School, the author of the book on the Gottesidee, on the idea of God, the thesis of which was that monotheism was the original religion of mankind, with the various pluralistic forms merely a kind of later perversion, and deterioration. This was combined with some kind of diffusionist Mesopotamian-centered theory. Father Schmidt, of course, liked Musil theories about the natural monotheism of the Bedouin, which fitted in very well with his own theory. The two men jointly were very influential at court, and were in fact accused, somewhat bizarrely, but one can see what people meant, they were accused of being the Rasputins of the Hofburg. Well, of course, Rasputin himself made a major contribution to the destruction of the Romanov Empire, whereas Musil, who remained an utterly loyal subject of the Habsburgs, did as much as anyone, both by his military activities and by his diplomatic ones, to which I'll come, to save the empire. Now, what happened through this, and of course he in no way resembled Rasputin, he was a highly sober, scholarly, puritanical, monotheism-oriented man, with no similarity whatever to the wild and woolly man of God at the court at St. Petersburg. The manner in which he used his influence came to bear was that by 1917, as he put it, both the new Kaiser, Karl, and he himself became convinced that the war was lost. There was only one way to save the Danubian monarchy, and that was by a separate peace. Now, this is the tangled story. Of course, this is the aspect of his life which most intrigues the Austrians, naturally. It's a tangled story, but what it amounted to was that a feeler was sent through Prince Sixtus's connections with Western courts. He was, of course, Bourbon. Sixtus was a Bourbon, and he claimed in a letter to Musil that he had about 57 sovereign rulers amongst his ancestors. I didn't think there were enough time slots or courts to allow a man to have 57 sovereign rulers, but I suppose if you count the little principalities of northern Italy, I suppose it can be done. But anyway, the feeler was sent out. The French leaked it, a sign of the weakness of the enemy, and then, of course, it had to be disavowed. It's not merely that treason never prospers, because if it prospers, no one dare call it treason. If it doesn't prosper, no one likes to admit it. And the story is very tangled, because Empress Zita lived for a very long time and talked a lot about it and contradicted her so many times that her evidence, as one of Musil's Austrian biographers says, has become worthless. Musil's own remarks about the matter are clear. The emperor and I both became convinced that the war was lost, and the basic idea was to save the Habsburg Empire by a separate peace in which their allies would be betrayed. The French were to be offered Alsace-Lorraine, the Russians were to be offered Istanbul, and the reward was to be that the Habsburg would retain the Danube Valley. It was not to be. But anyway, these are the two really crucial contributions of Musil to world history: the Lawrence-like activities in the desert, and intermittently, the diplomatic activities, the drafting of the letters which attempted to save Austria-Hungary by means of a separate peace. However, the story doesn't end there. Comes the end of the war, and the question arises,
obviously the question arises, where is Musil to continue his activities? The Viennese scholars wanted to retain him, and the Prague ones wanted to attract him, and what appears to have been decisive, at least according to the Austrian biographers, was a nasty little law, which one can understand what they had in mind, passed by the newly born, reluctantly born Austrian Republic, which restricted employment in the public service, which included the universities, to echt German-speaking Austrians, obviously trying to get rid of too many hangers-on from the previous extended empire. Nobody intended to apply this law to Musil, but they did try to make him fill out some forms so as to get around it, which infuriated him. And so he accepted a post, and eventually the chair of Arabic in Prague. Now, this aspect of the story is also very interesting. There were protests in the new Czechoslovak parliament against the employment of a man who was, after all, a war hero on the wrong side. But he was saved by his fellow Moravian peasant, the one several notches lower down on the social scale, by his fellow Moravian peasant son, Thomas Masaryk, who, like Musil himself, gravitated from Moravia, as was frequently the case, to Vienna, like Musil, rose from peasantry to become a professor, and was now the first president of the reborn Czech state. Now, it's very interesting. I'm trying to find the appropriate passage. Southern Moravia, it produces various things. It produces very good white wine, which Sainsbury's overprice. They make it about four times as expensive as it is where it comes from. But it also produces rather remarkable thinkers. Mendel, Freud, Husserl, Renner, Masaryk. Did I say Musil? I can think about six. Freud, Mendel, Husserl, Masaryk, Musil, and Renner, which is not a bad which is not a bad contribution to European thought. It's also interesting to reflect that in the early decades of the century, there were three Southern Moravians preoccupied with monotheism and morality: Sigmund, Alois, and Thomas. They came to rather different conclusions. Sigmund located the origins of monotheism not in the desert, but in complicated court intrigues in Egypt, and he thought that the Old Testament was really kind of cover-up of a murder. The Hebrews, after leaving Egypt under Moses' leadership, did in Moses and wrote the Old Testament largely to cover up the murder, but of course they couldn't deceive Sigmund. But the point about Jewish moralism and Puritanism is that it was doubly distilled, whereas all other nations had to commit the primal murder of the horde leader at least once. The Jews did it twice, first the first time round, like everybody else, and then again when they found in an excessively moralistic teacher somebody whose morality was a little too demanding, so they did him in, and then felt guilty of it thereafter and tried to cover it up with the Old Testament. The other two Southern Moravians had similar preoccupations. In the case of Masaryk, it led to his leaving the Catholic Church and adopting a form of Czech nationalism which idealized the Hussites as proto-Protestants, proto-individualists, moralists, anti-hierarchical. The Hussites didn't actually abolish the priesthood, But what distinguished them, what made them heretics within the church, were the fact that they insisted on not differentiating the laity and the priests in the ritual. The insistence that the laity as well as the priests should partake both of the wine as well as the wafer, both the blood and the body of Christ, is a kind of technicality on which the Hussites separated. Anyway, Masaryk overtly turned against the church. In the end, after vacillation, turned against the state which had been so closely associated with the Counter-Reformation absolutism, though by then the link had been attenuated and weakened. Whereas Musil, of course, found an extraordinary solution to the unambiguously Protestant feelings he had. He never left the church, and there's no evidence that he ever wanted to do so. He went through the appropriate ritual prior to his death. But the solution, of course, he found was in idealizing the Bedouin, in saying that it is the life of the desert which engenders monotheism, i.e. the truth which he himself endorsed. And in other words, of course, it's a way of underplaying any revelation. There's a certain difficulty about his position, and I haven't yet read all of his extensive work, so I don't know whether he copes with it. If monotheism is engendered by one kind of lifestyle and social organization, how is it to be valid for all mankind? Musil thought the desert engendered virtue, engendered truth. Ibn Khaldun believed the desert and the virtue. Maybe the answer is, but this I'm speculating now, is that we need to seek virtue through, that we need to seek truth through virtue, and the virtue is basically simplicity. There are difficulties about his position, apart from the one I mentioned. He has difficulty which he acknowledges. The Bedouin fit his case, the kind of proto-Moravian brethren, in as far as they have a solitary deity which scorns to employ magic or ritual or mediators or temples, but on the other hand, they are rather addicted to belief in Junoon. So there's a little difficulty there. And another thing he would have to say, and I'm not sure whether he said it, that the age of ignorance, Jahiliyyah, it must be a kind of projection by sophisticated urban Muslims onto the Bedouin, on Muslims' position. They were never in the state of ignorance. On the contrary, the purer they are, the more they are in a state of grace. And certainly, Musil's ethnographic work claims that the Bedouin were kind of natural and pure monotheists. They were virtually ignorant of proper Islam, which is only reaching them at about the same time as he was studying them. So that the simple and direct and moralistic monotheism was not the fruit of religious information, but directly engendered by his life. To give you the feel of his the deeply quote Protestant unquote instincts of the man, let me read an account of a conversation he had with a fellow Rawala Sheikh. This is Musil speaking. Divine service is different among nomads and settled people. Nomads have no sacred places, no images, no priests, not even rituals. In their religion, they closely resemble the biblical patriarchs. In friendly conversation, I asked my brother Nuri, Prince of the Rawala, how is it that you have no places dedicated to the service of Allah? Musa, that's Musil, we cannot have them. It takes us 5 years to camp again in the same place. Is not Allah present everywhere? We pray to him in foreign lands and serve him without sacred places or a temple. Have you no picture or object with which to represent God? We have none. As you have said to me, God is spirit. How could one represent spirit? Have you no mediation between yourselves and God? God is my Father. I am his Son. Is there need of mediation between Father and Son? This is one very, and this is the Catholic priest speaking, who of course was a professional mediator. There are other passages as striking, if I can find them. Yes, the other passage, which is comes from an unpublished book Musil was working on prior to his death, which was in Czech, bits of which were published in the catalogue to the Musil exhibition, which was organised at the centenary of his birth in 1968. Of course, 1968, certain other things happened in Prague, so the thing was eventually forgotten, though there was a plan to publish this work. I'll read again, it's Musil speaking. The traces of Old Testament Ark of the Covenant led me to the inner desert. I was eager to enter the psychic life of the true Semites, unmixed with alien elements, not subject to alien domination, and so never directly subject to an external enlightenment. The familiarity with the psychic activity of the true Semites in their homeland was very profitable for me, for it had to show me the reasons why it was just the Semites who bestowed the three monotheisms on the world. Why did the Semites solve mysteries whose significance escaped even the greatest Greek thinkers? Why were they just the Semites who created no philosophical schools, who enriched the ancient world with insights which are, even for us, the source of ever new conjectures? I could only answer these questions in the Arabian desert. It's very kind of powerful stuff. It's quite clearly he found, I mean, unlike the vicarious populists such as Lawrence and others, there are many amongst the French, who went to a Muslim tribal societies in order to recapture a tradition which they were losing at home, Musil wasn't really seeking tradition. He was seeking purity, and incidentally, he practiced it. He wasn't complete Puritan. I'm pleased to say that he was very fond of wine and used to take it along, including champagne, into the desert. But in other ways, he was clearly a Puritan. He once reproached one of his disciples for insisting on a weekly bath. Now, what is also interesting is his attitude to the then emerging Middle Eastern problem. One of his Austrian biographers claims, that there are two, Feigl and Bauer. Feigl claims that Musil was hostile to Zionist political aspirations, not indeed from any anti-Semitism, but from concern with the impact the achievement of the Zionist ideal would have on the local population. Now, the complication is, the situation is much more complex, and the other biographer, Bauer, offer the evidence on it. Incidentally, Max Brod wrote to Musil on this matter, and the letter survives, but unfortunately Musil's reply does not. But we do have a copy of an article Musil wrote in the Prager Presse, one of the two Prague German newspapers, in September 1921, shortly after one of the Zionist congresses in Karlsbad, in which he said the following: in this great hour, the Jewish people interest him as an Orientalist and as a man, and that he has always sympathized, mit empfinde, the German word he uses, with the striving of the Jewish soul since 1895. And he commends unity to Zionists if they are to achieve the end of a free and all-sided national life in their homeland, uses the German word in the word Heimat. Some of the advice he offers the Zionists is very interesting. Some of it is very, very profoundly Czech, and he was very, very Czech. He says, don't waste time in founding universities. That'll come of its own. What really matters is primary schools. That's where a nation is reborn. The correct strategy is to concentrate on elementary education, which is the basis of all else. One can easily imagine him echoing the Masarykian slogan of drobna práce, of small, modest, petty work, attend to the details, above all, primary school, the notion of the primary schoolmaster as the nation builder. Some other advice he offers clearly comes not from Musil the Czech, but Musil the Orientalist. He does think that reviving Hebrew is a bad idea. He said, and he uses the parallel of the return from the Babylonian exile. He said, when the Jews returned from that exile, they used Hebrew for religion, but for daily life they used Aramaic. Modern Arabic is no further from Hebrew than Aramaic. If you use, you should use Arabic instead, establish better contact with the environment, and incidentally, it's an interesting, again, anticipatory point, he says the use of it will help close the gap between the Middle East and Sephardim and European Jews. Incidentally, he was quite pessimistic about the possibility of converting Europeans to agricultural work in Palestine. It was too hot. The correct way to proceed was to study, to indulge in accurate Genaue ethnographic studies of the remaining Jewish agricultural communities in forgotten villages in Mesopotamia, and on the basis of that research to work out a strategy for repopulating the land. All this is exceedingly interesting. I should add, the great paradox, of course, of his later life was the friendship he developed with Masaryk. They'd spent the war doing exactly the opposite. Masaryk devoted himself to the dismantling of the Habsburg Empire. It's interesting to think Masaryk's strategy was to persuade the West of the importance of the Czech contribution to the war so as to get independence as the reward. And had, if only Musil had accepted the three British offers to join the British service, instead of being the kind of Austrian counter-image of Lawrence, he, in fact, would have been Lawrence. He would have no doubt done the job which was later assigned to Lawrence. And no doubt Masaryk, of course, would have used it in drawing up the balance sheets of the achievements so as to persuade the Allies to revive the Czech state. But the paradox was these men had done exactly the opposite during the war. After the war, they became friends. And it's not paradox. It's not really all that paradoxical. They were very similar. They're both Puritans. They both really disliked hierarchy, ritualism, and absolutism in religion. But they solved their problem differently. Masaryk, in leaving the church and idealizing the Hussites, Musil stayed in the church but idealized the Bedouin and treated them as a kind of proto-Moravian brethren. Both of their positions have their difficulties. And of course they became friends. Alas, there's no record of their conversation. I like to imagine the conversation must have gone something like this. Now listen, Alois, with your admiration for these Protestant traits of the Bedou, how on earth could you stay in that absolutist, hierarchical, ritualistic church? Well, Thomas, I think you're being terribly anachronistic in treating the Hussites, who were deep in the Middle Ages, as kind of modern social democrats. This is roughly how the conversation might have gone, but don't take that as evidence. I've just made it up. Well, you may wonder why. I mean, the announced program of my lecture was something to do with the anguish of the modern soul or something, and I forget the actual word they use. Well, the real reason why I'm talking about Musil, because I find him interesting. But I find reasons. He is very, very relevant, I think, to some of the some of the present situation. We are now, he was very much a man of the fin de siècle, and we're now at the fin de millénaire. And the situation has repeated itself. Of course, he's interesting in a number of ways. He was very much at the intersection of Habsburg loyalism and Czech nationalism. He was very much at the intersection of the two rival nationalisms underlying the Middle East conflict. As a passionate Puritan monotheist, he loved both. I mean, he was clearly philo-Semitic in the full sense of admiring both branches as the natural engenderers of monotheism. But he was also at the kind of interface of the conflict between clarity and obscurity. Let me read out a passage about the intellectual atmosphere of the time, a passage taken from the most famous work of Alois Musil's cousin, Robert Musil, from The Man Without Qualities. Out of the oil-smooth spirit of the two last decades of the 19th century, suddenly, throughout Europe, there rose a kindling fever. Nobody knew exactly what was on the way. Nobody was able to say whether it was to be a new art, a new man, a new morality, or perhaps a reshuffling of society. So everyone made of it what he liked. But people were standing up on all sides to fight against the old way of life. Men of practical enterprise joined forces with men of intellectual enterprise. Talents developed that had previously been choked. The contradictions in their aims were unsurpassable. The Superman was adored, and the Subman was adored. Health and the sun were worshipped, and the delicacy of consumptive girls was worshipped. People were enthusiastic hero worshippers and enthusiastic adherents of the creed of the man in the street. One had faith, and one was skeptical. One was naturalistic and precious, robust and morbid. If that epoch had been analyzed, some such nonsense would have come out as a square circle supposed to be made of wooden iron. They didn't have the word postmodernist then because they just thought they were modernists. But all this kind of strikes an echo. Well, of course, the relationship between Musil, Robert, and Musil, Alois, is very interesting. They knew each other, they corresponded, and again, as in case of Masaryk, there was a contrast. Robert Musil ironized Cacania. Alois Musil did his best on two quite different fronts to save it. But the interesting thing is this. I have no doubt now that not the character of Ulrich in The Man Without Qualities, but the plot, Robert Musil borrowed from the life of his second cousin. The plot of Musil's novel, you'll remember, of course, is the launching of a campaign to propagate the fame of Austrian culture. It was a kind of and of course the whole humor hinges on this overlap of high society ladies, high politics, and high scholarship. The intertwining at the top. Well, of course, this is precisely what happened in Musil's life through his close connection with the last Kaiser and Kaiserin. When Musil, for instance, founded an Oriental society for the promotion of Austrian commerce, culture, and prestige in the Middle East, the founding committee really was to Vienne. I mean, to everybody who was anybody. The Crown Prince was on it, the Mayor of Vienna was on it,
Freiherr von Skoda, of the Skoda works on it, and so on. You simply, anybody who's anybody, had to be on it. And Musil was in this world. Musil was the organizer. So it seems to be fairly obvious that Robert borrowed the theme from the life of Alois for the plot of that novel. However, whilst Musil's life clearly belongs to the world of the man without qualities, to those hectic, hysterical, complex last decades of the Habsburg Empire, his mind did not. There was a superb simplicity and clarity about what he wrote. The idea that clarity is a mode of domination, and that in order to show your sympathy with the cultural underdogs, you have to write extremely cumbersome, unintelligible, and complex and contradictory prose, is totally alien to him. I have yet to come across a sentence in Alois Musil which is anything other than clear. So that my final reason for invoking him and holding him up as a model, he really is a striking answer to those who would treat Western students of other societies as hidden malicious dominators who use their clarity to put others down. He clearly, though he was clear and simple and straightforward, but there's no condescension or hostility or attempt to dominate of the people from whom he was very, very eager.
End of sermon.